Welcome, 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 family. My name is Jan Desper Peters, and I am your host of the BTST Services Podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. Meeting You Are Where You Are is more than a podcast, though. It's more than a tagline. It's a movement. It's a movement where we share factual and relevant information on real life issues that may affect your emotional wellness. Our guests are usually subject matter experts or real people with real lived experiences on a particular topic. Though every topic may not resonate with you or where you are at this moment, we believe the messages are a resource to inspire, inform, transform, and empower. Check out our YouTube channel for past episodes and like, share, and subscribe so that you'll know when we drop new episodes. So subscribe on Podomatic, SoundCloud, and the Apple Podcast app. So now sit back and listen up as we share with my very good guest today, who will explore some of the issues around mental health as they pertain particularly to creating a pipeline of Black mental health providers. I'm going to ask my guest to come in now, and I'm going to introduce him as he comes in. I have a very special guest today, Dr. Vabren Watts. He's the Deputy Director of the Division of Diversity and Health Equity for the American Psychiatric Association. And as a national spokesperson of mental health care for diverse populations, Dr. Watts dedicates himself to making clinical findings and other aspects of minority health more comprehensible for the scientific and medical community through his hundreds of publishings. I just told him that he looks like a very young man, so I can't believe he has hundreds of publishings. As a medical journalist, he's also the founder of The Science Journalist, a freelance science and health reporting and technical writing service, where he serves as an expert to big clients like WebMD and Psychiatric News. Dr. Watts graduated with his PhD in biomedical sciences from Meharry Medical College and completed his postdoctoral training in cardiology research at the illustrious Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome, my friend, Dr. Watts.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Peters. Good to see you again.
I know.
To connect with you.
I love talking to Vabren because he always has such a sunny disposition. He's always smiling. He always has, you know, some, you know, lighthearted disposition, and just love talking to you, Vabren. And so when I wanted to highlight the fact that July in 2008 was announced to be National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, I figured what better person to reach out to than a Black PhD researcher who can talk to us about the scientific and medical aspect of Black mental health. And that's you. And so I'm so glad that you agreed to be with us this morning. How are you doing during this pandemic?
You know what? I'm doing great. You know, at first it was a transition. You know, like my job, actually, we were supposed to do a trial run, you know, with, you know, teleworking. And Then the trial run actually became the real thing. So it was difficult initially. But, you know, the science shows that it takes humans like 90 days to adjust. Now I have adjusted and not looking forward to returning to the office soon. I have my, you know, my rhythm going with like working from home, things like that.
Right. I know what you mean. I really, I have always worked half home and then, you know, kind of floated into an office space, but I'm good working from home. I'm very productive and I'm always finding something that needs to be done. And you know, working from home is good for me.
And sometimes I know, like, you know, we have to watch it working from home because sometimes we tend to overwork from home.
That's my issue. That's my issue because I'm like, oh, well, you know what? I mean, if I don't have a meeting tomorrow morning, then I can stay up later and work on this. You
know? Yes.
It's like, no, you still have to have, you know, some boundaries. That's another podcast, you know, setting boundaries.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Have you started doing anything that you would normally have said, I just don't have time to do this, or some kind of project, even in your home, that you had put aside, but now that you've been in sheltering in place, you're all in?
Oh, you know what? You know what? Exactly. You know what I've done? I finally cleaned out my closet. I had so much stuff in my closet, and now it's like half full now. I mean like stuff. Wow. I was like, why? Or like, why when I moved, I took it from this place to that place to this place, knowing I wasn't going to wear it. So I did do that. I also was able to, as you mentioned, I do have my company, The Science Journalist. I was also able to actually get back into that, like have more time for that. And so, you know, I was able to write for WebMD on COVID and HIV and things like that. And I'm also writing for another company about ovarian breast cancer, well, ovarian and breast cancer, as well as prostate and pancreatic cancer. So I've been able to really, do some things that I thought I didn't have time to do. So it's been great.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So Vabren, tell us a little bit about yourself. You consider yourself to be a health equity practitioner. Can you explain more about what that means to be a health equity practitioner, and then how you even decided that research and scientific writing were the field that you wanted to get into?
Yeah, so I'm actually going to start back. You know, I always have a story, Jan.
I know you do. I know. That's why I love you.
So I'm actually going to take you through a timeline on how I got to where I am now. So it's interesting, as you could probably tell. As a child, I grew up in the theater.
Right.
Like charismatic. And so, but I also like science. So that was always like a dichotomy, you know, it's that whole, you know, I'm both a left brain and right brain person.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, you know, when I got into college, I actually majored in biology, but I was also the lead anchor on our news station, you know, at 5 o'clock. And so, you know, that continued. And then when I got to Meharry Medical College, when I was working on my PhD, I basically was working on my PhD researching in pharmacology. And then on the weekend, I was on a local sitcom in Nashville. that was like helping people, you know, think about, you know, life things or whatever, like pretty much helping people through like life experience through acting. And so when I came up to Johns Hopkins, I was actually, you know, researching at Johns Hopkins by day and actually working as a men's fashion blog writer by night. And so what I did, I actually meshed the two together and said, you know what, I really like, you know, the science writing that goes on. So I actually became a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, their mass media fellowship, where they try to get PhDs, MDs, DDSs into making sure that they're able to convey science to the lay public. And so that's how I was able to get into that. And then when I came, I took a leave of absence for Hopkins for like probably like 6 months, 6 to 9 months. And when I came back, I was actually connected with the American Heart Association, where I started getting into health disparities and looking at marginalized populations such as Black and Latinx populations. And so after, I completed my research at Hopkins, I said, you know what? I love scientific research, but you know what? I think my calling is not really actually doing the scientific work, but I love to report on the scientific work. And so that's when I took a job at the American Psychiatric Association as their senior writer for psychopharmacology, that's drugs for mental illness. And then I started dabbling since I had a health disparities background, I started dabbling in mental health care of marginalized populations, which we historically marginalized populations, as I like to say, which we know is Black, Latinx, Asian Americans, and American Indians, indigenous people. And I was actually poached by the incoming director of the Division of Diversity and Health Equity. And so this is where I am now as the deputy director of the Division of Diversity and Health Equity at APA. And I've been able to...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I didn't know that we had a similar background, not the scientific piece, but I also am a journalist at heart. So I have an undergraduate degree in journalism, and just, you know, always admire people who love the art. And I consider it art, the art of writing, because everybody can't do it.
Right. And you know, it's interesting. It is a gift. And I must say that I was hired at most of my jobs, even my postdoc at Hopkins, because that I could write. Mm-hmm. And so
it comes few and far between. So I just want to just use something that you said to drill down on where we are in this space as it relates to the COVID-19, and really look at the numbers that we're seeing and experiencing in the Black community as it relates to those who are being infected, hospitalized, and dying. And that the numbers of people, even though we don't represent the majority population, we represent the majority of the folks who are dying, hospitalized, and becoming infected. And I know you said you've written something for WebMD on the COVID experience. And so just your thoughts on this kind of unmasking, pulling the covers off the fact that forever we've had issues of health disparities and health inequity in those marginalized communities, and then what this means as we are in this space of COVID for that community.
You know what, Jan, you said it the best. You said unmasked. It was like, you know, I've heard people say, well, this is new. I'm sorry. Health disparities have never been new. Health disparities have been around since the creation of the U.S. medical system. And so, you know, with COVID-19, you know, we are 13% of the population. I'm going to talk from an aspect of African-Americans, but we are 13% of the population. But you know, around 48% of us are being infected by COVID the last time I checked. And then when the CDC put, you know, numbers out that said that, you know, that minority population, 70% were, they accounted for 70% of the death. So, I mean, a lot of things goes into that. And I know, you know, a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of media when it first came out that first said, oh, well, you know, it's because, you know, these populations have like underlying conditions and things like that. Right. It actually goes further than that. You know, a lot of people are talking about structural racism right now. Mm-hmm. So it really stems from structural racism. I mean, when we look at, you know, the preventative measures for actually, thwarting COVID, just not getting it, is really to decrease your exposure. And then, you know, we have to face the fact that a lot of people cannot afford to decrease their exposure to it. I mean, you look at jobs, you know, I know the U.S. Department of Labor came out, you know, when this pandemic first happened, it was saying that, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, we have marginalized populations being heavily impacted by this is because you got to look at their jobs and like, mm-hmm. do they have jobs that allow them to telework? Right.
And they became the frontline workers.
Yes.
And the hospitals, they became the frontline workers, and it became mandatory that they come to work.
Exactly. And if you look at it by telework, you have, you know, 30 to 32% of white people who are able to telework. And then you look at the next group, which is African Americans, 18% are able to telework. Then you have our Latinx population, which is 14%. So you look at the disparity from that. And then you also look at, you know, living conditions, housing situations in some of our urban cities. We have, you know, race and ethnic minorities living, you know, close with each other in like close proximities. And so, you know, it's how things have set up due to, you know, job disparities, due to housing disparities or housing discrimination in some cases, you know, it has not really been advantageous. Just health disparities in general has not been, well, just health period has not been advantageous to non-white people. So we really have to take that into consideration before we start getting into, oh, African-Americans have, you know, higher rates of, you know, high blood pressure, things like that. So you have to ask the question, why do they have that? So, you know, that's something that, you know, we really have to, you know, figure out and dive into. I will say to your question to, like, you know, what is like health equity? Because I know that's a term that a lot of people throw around. Exactly. And so it's a lot of definitions out there. But my definition of health equity is actually just simple. And that's just making sure that everyone, regardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, nationality, or geographics, have actually equal and adequate access to healthcare across the board. That goes for indigenous person, our Native Americans have the same access to healthcare as, you know, our Caucasian brothers and sisters. So we just really want to make sure that, you know, everyone has access to healthcare, but also access to high quality healthcare is everyone.
Faber, and so when I look at the information that's put out, you know, around the science, and I'm so glad that you are a scientist and I can ask a true scientist this question, you know, the conversation always kind of circles around testing and tracing and, you know, just really understanding that those things need to happen in our community in order to flatten the curve. Every time we think the curve is flattening in one place, then it spikes in another place because, you know, primarily for economic reasons. People want to open back up the economy. They want people to go back out and act as if business was as usual, and it's not. We have this whole conversation now about whether or not schools are going to open. I just want to have you just inform those who are listening about the importance of testing and tracing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's very important that we test and trace. One thing I noticed in the United States, I think it's outside of the United States, but I'm just going to speak from the United States. I think, for instance, like when it first happened, you know, it was like it started in Seattle and, you know, people on the East Coast was like, oh, my goodness, it's a bad time to be in Seattle. That really doesn't affect us. Then, you know, you had the major increase in just catastrophic, you know, spread of COVID-19 in New York. And so we had our southern states that were like, well, you know, that really doesn't affect us. That's New York. And so now, you know, our southern states are being impacted by this. And then, you know, and some people think that, you know, well, you know, because this is really being heavily actually spread in the, you know, minority population, then I'm okay. Right. Well, the numbers are showing actually now that the infection among, you know, white Americans is actually increasing, and it's closing the gap. So with that, you know, we really have to be vigilant and to realize that we're all in this together, and right. that if you and like even though you may be in, let's say, Montana right now, you know, it's not to say that that will eventually affect you. I always say this one quote from Martin Luther King. He always says, you know, what affects one group of us eventually affect us all. And right. just to get on, you know, is that sort of a shift towards like the mental health care, you know, that's sort of what happened when we look at the opiate epidemic, you know, in the 1960s, the opiate epidemic, the profile was, you know, Hispanic or, you know, black male, you know, who was on opiates. Like I think in 1968, it was like 70% of opiate users were like minority black males.
And many of those black males came from the Vietnam War.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So you know, they didn't really see it as a problem because right. it doesn't affect our population. But as I said, as Martin Luther King said, if you don't address something now, it eventually will affect us all. And then you shift, you know, 40 years later, and it's completely opposite. 70% of opiate users are white people. And with a high percentage with like white women. So like, you know, we really have to be vigilant. And, you know, when, you know, another place is social distancing, we should really follow lead because, right, as we know right now, people are global and they travel and it takes no time to really, you know, for things to really spread as it relates to COVID.
Right. I'm uber sensitive. My husband took me to get ice cream this weekend, right? And we went to Annapolis and it was, first of all, it was too many people out for me. He always teases me. He's like, you know, you got to get out of the house. And I'm like, no, I feel safe here. But we got into the ice cream shop and people were in line. And the first thing I said was, they don't have any markings on the floor. They need to have markings. He said, look down at your feet. And there was a big blue X under my feet. And I was like, oh, okay. But then I'm always like very conscious of people, you know, because primarily I'm going to the grocery store and yes. I'm like 6 feet, six feet yes. away. Because I understand that, you know, according to the science, that they believe that this, you know, if people can spray from talking or
nasal
cavity that the virus doesn't spread, shouldn't spread any further than 6 feet. And that's why it's important to stay, you know, to be so physically distanced at 6 feet. And I think that that's important because sometimes we tell people to do things and they don't know why. You know, it's almost like a child. You know, when I was a child, when my mom told me something, it was because I said so. When I had my children, I was more inclined to explain to them why.
Yes. You know,
my parents probably thought, you know, I don't have to explain myself. And I think, you know, my mother always said when, you know, every generation gets weaker but wiser. And in my wisdom with my children, I felt that they would not necessarily that I had to explain everything that I, you know, told them I thought they should do, but that the why helped them to understand better and the compliance rate was higher when you explain to someone why they're doing it. So that's why it's important to stay 6 feet apart.
Exactly. You know,
that's why it's important to wear a mask, because really wearing a mask is to protect the other people. And so I, you know, have been saying in my podcast when I have the opportunity is that people should feel like, you know, this, just like you said, it's not only affecting one group of people. It's affecting everybody. We're all in this together. So we need to not have this us versus them mentality.
Exactly.
And that we need to understand that in being in this together, we need to be concerned about the other guy or the other lady, right? Or the child, because not necessarily am I going to get it, but I don't want to give it to anybody else. And then there's this whole area around being asymptomatic and you don't even have any
symptoms. Yeah.
You don't even know that you have it. So that's my soapbox and about that. But I did want to ask you, as a researcher, when we look at these big pharmaceutical companies that are working on immunizations and the fact that the number of percentage of Black folks that normally would participate in clinical trials is already traditionally low. And then there's this sense of distrust around, you know, research and being considered, you know, lab rats. Like, how do we get our people, you know, just aware of what it means to be in a clinical trial and more maybe open to doing it?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the, that has been a conundrum for years, especially since the, you know, Tuskegee trials, because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the medical system has not been particular to racial and ethnic minorities, particularly African Americans. I mean, if you go back to the days of that Black people were enslaved, you know, a lot of advancements in U.S. medicine were off the back of Black people. Particularly, we look at gynecology, you know, it was off the back of like a Black women, you know, where they pretty much perform these procedures on enslaved women with like no anesthesia whatsoever. Right. And so
we had this high tolerance for pain.
Yes. And actually, that's where that misconception comes from, which actually still stands today with our community. And so, and then you move forward and you look at, you know, the Tuskegee experiment where, you know, I just read a book called Medical Apartheid, which is a very, very good book, which talks about health disparities. And it goes through like days of enslavement up until like 2000 about just how racial and ethnic minorities were abused by the medical system. But during the Tuskegee experiment, you know, these men, you know, actually had syphilis and they thought that they were being treated for syphilis because that's what the government told them. But however, 2 years after the study started, there was a cure for syphilis. But the government did not tell them about that cure because they wanted to look at the progression of the disease and what happens over 25 years. And at the end of that study, those men were given like a golden award from the U.S. government and a check for $25 for each year of the study. So, you know, when you have things that are in place like, you know, like that, the Tuskegee experiments, you know, how the evolution of gynecology, you know, African-Americans are a little hesitant within getting into those studies. And with that being said, they're working on like now, like really trying to get a, we call it a physician-patient concordance going along, where, you know, sometimes, you know, just having the presence of like a physician that looks like you helps you feel more comfortable. I will tell you about a study that says like why diversity matters, which came out last year. It was called the Oakland Men Study, where they pretty much had 1,000 men, black men in the Oakland area, and they actually gave them flyers of physicians. And on the flyers, they actually had faces of physicians, male physicians who were black and non-black. And it was only for, you know, to come and get your flu shot. So when they did the study, they actually found out that the results showed that men were more likely to go to physicians who looked like them, who were black. And then of the men who actually chose the black physicians, they were more likely to follow up with that physician and actually receive medical treatment for like other things, such as like, you know, oh, checking like their cardiometabolic risk. And so, you know, with doing that, actually the study found that, you know, having a physician that who resembles you first increases, you know, adherence, you know, among patients, but it also increases like a follow-up, and it also reduces mortality due to cardiometabolic risk by 18% among black men, which, you know, have like one of the lowest life expectancy rates that there is. So, you know, so as we sort of figure out, we don't have the answers on how to actually get more African Americans into studies because they're a little distrustful. I may even say, you know, after reading certain things and know about what happened, I'm a little distrustful of things. And I ask certain questions. What are you using this for? You know, this and that. So that is really, you know, something that, you know, we really have to work out. And I must say now that because, you know, some people are distrustful, it has led more medical companies and pharmaceutical companies to actually go to other continents to actually, you know, test the drugs on them.
Right, right. I want to pivot to something that you said as it related to the flyer and people being more trustful of people that look like them. I know that, in doing some research that less than 2% of, you can correct me if my math is off. When we look at, African Americans or African, related persons, in the mental health field, less than 2% are in that ethnic group. And so I know that you have been working at the APA to create a pipeline for African-American males who may be interested in psychiatry. And so I wanted you to talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so APA has a program called the Black Men in Psychiatry Early Pipeline Program. And this program was actually inspired by the American Association of Medical Colleges. They put out a infographic called Altering the Course, where they actually looked at, progression of black males in medicine, from like 1974 to 2014. And so what they found was that when it came to applicants, actually black males, it was more black males entering medical school in 1974 significantly than it was in 2014, which is a major problem because, you know, as we progress and, you know, as, you know, this is, you know, as we become more educated, you know, what was the problem? Like, why do we have this decrease? Because we know that if you diversify, you know, the workforce, like we said, if you can decrease mortality rates, you know, among certain populations. So with that being said, we started the program in our backyard, as we say, which is Howard University, right, where we recruited three students to come along on this journey. We actually exposed them to the field of psychiatry. We connected them with a mentor. They went to our annual meetings. They presented at meetings with us. And since then, we now actually have 20 young men in the program. And I would say out of the first cohort, which started in 2016 with three freshman males, two out of the three will be starting as medical students this year. one at the University of San Francisco, University of California, San Francisco, and the other one at Temple. So the program has been deemed successful, and then we actually extended the program to other racial and ethnic minority groups. Indigenous people also, over the past decade, has seen a 50% decrease in applicants into medical school. And so we started the Indigenous People Early Pipeline Program, as well as the Hispanic American Early Pipeline Program. So, you know, right now, out of all the three programs, we have actually 30 people involved in the program. And so we just plan to continue doing this and really making an impact to diversify the psychiatric workforce.
I mean, that's wonderful. I think that, you know, whether it's business or life, that being around people who are doing what we want to do and they're doing it successfully, whether you call it mentoring or coaching, that's the best route, because then they can also help you maybe avoid some of the bumps and turns that they experienced, so that you can have a better road to whatever your goal is. So I'm very, very happy about that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about, just the stigma. I know that when we talk about mental health, and I started out by saying that July was named in recognition of B.B. Moore Campbell and National Minority Mental Health Month, we talk about stigma. I just wanted to know, in, you know, just working at the APA and doing the writings that you do and working with the other medical organizations that you're working with, have you seen a change in attitude as it relates to mental health, specifically in the African-American community?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, mental health stigma is interesting, because it's on like a scale. It's sort of like, and I'm sure every African-American person sort of observed this. My acceptance to mental health care is totally different from my mother's. Right. And, you know, each generation, it definitely gets better. But that is one thing that, you know, we have really pushed at APA, especially within, you know, historically marginalized communities, is that, you know, that we're marginalized just in general, just by our skin, you know, pigmentation, just by the pigmentation in our skin. And to have mental health is another, you know, stigma that's layered on top of that. So, you know, that's, some of the reasons why, you know, you do have such a high stigma for mental health within these marginalized populations, particularly African Americans. And so, you know, what we've really been doing, just been doing like campaigns for like mental, for stigma, really going into the schools. You know, you have to start early to really demystify, you know, mental health, so people can know what mental health are. What mental health is. And so, that's one of the things that we do with the Black Men in Psychiatry Early Pipeline Program, is that even though they're in the program, they're also ambassadors for mental health. So we require them actually to have something at their college, you know, about, you know, mental health. We provide, you know, funds to them just to bring like some psychiatrists in, you know, some mental health experts in, so they can talk about mental health and just demystify it. And so, you know, as we really, you know, focus on our, you know, young people, we're really, you know, demystifying mental health, you know, for future generations. And then at the same time, these young people can also inspire like their parents. I know, like, for instance, you know, when my father died, the first thing I said was, I said, well, you know, I need to have grief therapy. And so, you know, because I had grief therapy, then it led my sisters to have grief therapy. Then we came to my mom, and she was like, I don't know about grief therapy. But when she saw us do it, and she was like, okay, I'm beginning to be more open and receptive to grief therapy. And so you really have to think of novel ways to really engage certain people. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, now that she's being receptive to it, we're not going to let her go to grief therapy by herself. We'll do it as a family, because she means that communal thing. So it's really about just really, I don't want to say the word marketing, I'm going to say that, but you really have to market therapy and mental health therapy and demystify stigma to certain groups in certain ways. So you have to be creative with it. And I know for a lot of African-Americans and a lot of people of color, we come from these very collective communities. So sometimes you do have to go with people so they can feel more comfortable with it, until they get to the point where they can go by themselves.
I think that that what you said was very on point with regard to demystifying it, and that there's not a one size fit all model as it relates to introducing mental health and mental health treatment to a particular person. I think that is really, you know, important to understand, especially when we're talking about the church and, you know, the religious community and the historical thinking around, you know, just pray about it, or that someone is not having enough faith because they think they also need a therapist. And just, you know, just saying that you can pray about it and have a therapist. You know, you can have Jesus and a therapist, you know, and really help people understand that, and helping pastors understand that, so that they can then encourage their parishioners that if you have hypertension or you have diabetes, there are people who are trained to provide services to you to help to, you know, mitigate any other risks that are related to that, and to help hopefully extend your life. And the same thing is available to you for your head. So,
Exactly. And like, you know, there, APA has definitely done, you know, some work with the faith community and mental health. And, you know, just to, and it's pretty much just to let, you know, people know that, you know, when you search for your mental health professionals, you can also put in that search, you know, sometimes they have it. If you go through, like, you know, different insurances and things like that, sometimes they have it where it was like, oh, well, do you want this mental health professional to be male or, you know, or a woman? But also it asks you your religious views, because sometimes you can get a therapist who has the same religious views as you. So, you know, it's really important that, you know, that we really be open to mental health care. And you know what? It is not, contradicting, you know, your faith, put it that way, because they actually can come together and serve you in the best way possible.
Yeah, I always tell people to think of it as, first of all, you finding the right person for you. And don't feel like once you identify a therapist that if you find that it doesn't work for you, that you can't then identify someone else. The other piece of therapy is that when you were talking about needing grief counseling, I was in the same position when my mom died. I had never had therapy before, but I was like, I need grief counseling, right? And I didn't necessarily have to be in therapy forever. I mean, I think people's like, once you get in, you know, you have to be in therapy forever. You know, some therapy is episodic. It's time limited, right? And then this whole issue around, well, I don't want to be on medication. Well, being in therapy doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be on medication. It could mean that, right? Yes. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. And so you have to, like you said, be open to all that's available and see what works for you.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's so many misconceptions around therapy. And then, like you said, it's so many forms of therapy that are available. I know for instance, mine was like, I wanted the person to be male. I wanted them to be black. I wanted them to be, you know, a Christian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I actually found that. And then, you know, with other parts of therapy, it may be like, oh, well, you know, I'm not feeling, you know, really motivated. So I didn't use the grief therapist, of course, because sometimes you may have multiple therapists for different things. Yeah. So, you know, one may be for grief. One may be for situations on job or like, you know, situations in your family, marriage. So, you know, it's really like I said earlier, Black people are collective. So sometimes when it comes to therapy, you have to have that collective community to get, you know, one sound person out of yourself.
So that sounds like a piece of advice that you would just kind of generically give to people, is that if you, you know, are thinking about therapy, maybe doing it as a family as opposed to doing it individually. Is there any final note that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would like to share with them that, you know, as you said, this month is B.B. Moore Campbell's Mental Health Month, and APA is doing a campaign on mental health each day. If you go and look at our Twitter page or you look at our Facebook page, you will see educational resources to treat mental health and or just to talk about it. It's very helpful. One mental health tip is a fact sheet for African Americans. And then another big project that we pulled off in the past year is actually called a Stress and Trauma Toolkit for Treating Marginalized Populations. And it talks about how histories of the past affect our psyche of today, which is very good. And it's written in layman's term, totally specifically. And it's broken down into sections by African American, Jewish Americans, Muslim Americans, Hispanic Americans. It's very, very, very good. And just check it out. You will enjoy it and share it with everyone that you know.
Well, we'll get the social media handles from you, and so that when we post the podcast, we'll add those to the list so that people can have access to those. Vaibhren, I want to thank you again for doing this interview. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And we have run out of time, but you know, in the future, when you're doing some, and I know you'll be doing some more amazing things.
Yes.
You'll come back to the podcast and show people what this brilliant Black research PhD is doing in the world of health and mental health. So until we meet again, family, stay safe, stay healthy, wear a mask, physically distance at least 6 feet apart, and when you can, stay home. God bless you. And please remember to subscribe on Podomatic, SoundCloud, and the Apple Podcast app. God bless you.
Thank you.